listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Salman Rushdie calls Ariel Dorfman one of the most important voices to come out of Latin America. Born in Argentina and raised in both the United States and Chile, Ariel Dorfman threw himself into the momentous democratic movement that brought Salvador Allende to power in Chile in 1970. He took a position as cultural advisor to the president's chief of staff. Then on that dark day, September 11th, 1973, Pinochet seized power, assassinating President Allende and throwing the country into a convulsion of military repression and fear. It was the nightmarish conclusion to Chile's popular revolution and quite nearly to Ariel Dorfman's life. Dorfman was banished from Chile, but he was already no stranger to exile. His own father, a communist, was forced to leave Argentina with his family for Chile, then the United States, before being hounded out of the United States during the McCarthy era. Along with his wife and small son, Ariel Dorfman first sought refuge in Argentina, where he was born, then Amsterdam, Paris, and finally the United States over the next 20 years. And in his passionate new book, Feeding on Dreams, Confessions of an Unrepentant Exile, he reminds us that we are all exiles. He explores his long voyage and the complex consequences of tyranny and revolution. And as we witness upheaval in the world, all over the world today, his own witnessing of living through the turmoil of a transition to democracy could not be more relevant. Ariel Dorfman is the author of many internationally acclaimed works of poetry, fiction, and nonfiction, including his memoir, Heading South, Looking North, which was the basis for the documentary film A Promise to the Dead, shortlisted for the Academy in 2008, and his many plays, including Death and the Maiden, have been staged in over 100 countries and his books published in over 40 languages. He is currently the Walter Hines Page Chair of Literature and Latin American Studies at Duke University. And in conversation with Ariel tonight is Mark Cooper, who went to Chile at the age of 20 and wound up working as translator for President Allende. He says he was just in the right place at the right time. He narrowly survived the September 11th military coup and wrote his memoir of those times, Pinochet and Me, which we have for sale tonight, which is widely praised. Mark has had a distinguished career as a journalist. His articles, essays, and interviews have appeared in scores of newspapers and magazines. He's won a slew of awards, and you can read much of his international and domestic reporting from the late 80s and early 90s in his book, Rollover Che Guevara, Travels of a Radical Reporter. He's currently on the faculty at the USC Annenberg School and serves as associate director of Annenberg's Institute for Justice and Journalism. Our distinguished guests, Ariel Dorfman and Mark Cooper, please join me in welcoming them to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Okay, because I'm shorter.
No, thank you.
This is short and tall. Well, thank you for coming, and make sure that you support the Public Library Foundation. Very important. It's a pleasure to speak with Ariel tonight. We were reminiscing a little bit before the before you arrived. We had similar experiences, sort of, in Chile. Probably worked about 100 feet from each other and didn't know each other in Chile, but I knew Ariel because when I arrived there and I was 20 years old, I learned Spanish by reading, and one of the first books that I could read in Spanish had the great title of How to Read Donald Duck. That was written by Ariel and by a Belgian by the name of Armando Matelhart. And I was saying to Ariel that I looked at this book and said, knowing nothing about Chile when I arrived, I said, I wonder who these strange foreigners are, some French guy and some Jewish guy. What do they know about Chile writing in Spanish? That was my introduction to it.
And I said back to Mark, no wonder you went insane.
Well, it was a great experience to arrive and to see a book, especially when one was my age at 20 years old in 1971, to read a book that had an anti-imperialist analysis of Donald Duck, something I hadn't seen before. So speaking of empires,
yes.
Let's begin with where we're at. And let's begin with the question of exile. And I'll kind of wrap two or three questions into one. You assert that we're all exiles. You are a little bit more of an exile than others.
It's like Orwell, right?
Right.
Some people are equal, but some people are more equal than others. I'm more of an exile than most exiles.
Right. But in your particular case, I wanted to ask you, because you're in a situation where your parents were forced out of the United States because of McCarthy.
Before that, they were forced out of Argentina because of the generals,
of
right?
The anti-communist right. wave in Argentina. You were forced out of Chile by a coup that was supported by the United States. You now have made a life at Duke University by choice.
Yes.
What is it? Do you feel like an exile in the United States? Or do you feel that this is your country? Or are those questions even relevant?
Well, you know, I feel as much of an exile as probably most of the people in this room. So the fact is that there have always been two Americas fighting for the soul of America, right? And so if you say, am I in the America of Faulkner and of Steinbeck and of Nat Turner and of Cesar Chavez, yeah, I feel very comfortable in that America or that dream of America, right? And if you say, am I in the country of George W. Bush and Kissinger and Nixon, and then, you know, I would say that I feel alienated from them because I think that they betray the promise that America has. Now, having said that, clearly my situation is a very peculiar one, to put it mildly, because I was brought up as a child here. That's why I speak the English that I speak. Y pueden creerme aquellos que hablan castellano que yo hablo el castellano que hablo. In other words, I'm not bilingual. I am entirely doubly monolingual. In other words, I speak Spanish as I speak English, and I write Spanish like I speak English, which is really strange in the sense generally people don't write both languages at the same time, in the same way. In other words, people don't write in the New York Times and El País. There's nobody who does that.
Right.
Right? There are people who have translated, right? Carlos Fuentes will have it translated, but he doesn't write in English and in Spanish the same article or different articles. So the fact that I became an American kid, an all-American kid, which was perhaps, I think, one of the reasons why I was able to critique Donald Duck, because I was critiquing my own seduction by American culture, as Armand Matelat was critiquing his seduction by Tintin, right?
Right.
In Belgium. That's why these two foreigners were the ones who saw things that the Chilenos did not see.
Yeah.
They were able to see what the empire had done to their souls, and therefore, in some sense, both of us projected that onto the people of Chile. It wasn't certain. We can go into that, but just go on with the theme of exile. So when I leave Chile, having by then decided that I will only speak in Spanish, that I am a child of the revolution, that I am the godchild of Allende in some sense, as you were his translator, right? And that my fate is intertwined and entangled with the Spanish language and with the fate of the people of Latin America, and therefore that's what I go out with. I go out like this, right? This is the young man who goes out. So I go out thinking that the United States is not a place I want to go for two reasons. One is because it's imperial and it's done this terrible thing to my country. And the second is because if I go there, I might stay. Right? And part of what this book is laying bare the contradictions of my own condition, mm-hmm. rather than papering it over and making believe they're not there. My coming here, when I do end up here without my wanting to stay here, because I'm on my way to Mexico, Mexicans didn't want me. So I stay here, and I stay against my will, and then I begin writing in English. And I begin, in some sense, to reconcile with the fact that we don't have to live in an either-or situation. Identity is not a zero sum. It is something which is an amalgam, a combination, a mix, where we become members of many overlapping communities, as long as they're not at war with one another. They can be at war within yourself. But that jostling, that crowding inside yourself allows me to feel very comfortable in this country, or very uncomfortable in this country, but very native to the country in that sense.
This memoir is very personal, much more personal than political. It's really a journey into your own self and into your own conflicts, as illustrated by the conflicts that you live through. One of the recurring themes in this book and in your earlier memoir is, in fact, this struggle, if you will, between the two languages in your head. Yes. And I think this is a library, so we can talk about language.
Oh, we'd better. If we don't do it here, where will we do it?
Why was this such a struggle for you? I mean, because at some point you're giving away a little bit of the book, which is fine. Uh-huh. At some point, you make the decision, damn it, you're only going to write in Spanish. And then...
As a child, I said, I'm only going to speak in English, right?
Right.
But, you know, let's put it like this. One of the reasons why I wrote the first book, Heading South, Looking North, is because it came in the middle of the Siege of Sarajevo. And I said, you know, those people who are attacking a multicultural, multilinguistic, multi-religious city, this attack on that, in the name of fundamentalism, meaning in the name of one truth which is mine, generally comes from God, right, or some such entity, or from ethnicity, or from religion, or from nationalism, right, or from race, saying, I'm only this. And I said, I used to be, in some sense, those people. In other words, I was once not a hybrid. Or in fact, I was always a hybrid. I was always a mongrel. I was always a mix of different things, as we all are, of course. I mean, we come from the strangest combination, which is a woman and a man. Everybody here. So nothing could be stranger than the joining of these two to create a new creature, right? And so anybody who wants to, Solomon, like to cut them in half, right, is absolutely mad, right? And that's why the world is so mad. But I saw that fundamentalism in myself, that I had once said, I will not speak another word of Spanish because it abandoned me when I was a child of 2.5 in a hospital. I will not speak another word of English because English is the language of the imperialist, right? And then, you know, history ended up kicking me out of my country, destroying that country. And when I left, I discovered that my language, the language I'm speaking to with some elegance and eloquence, is one that allowed me to further the cause. In other words, if I'm able to save a life by speaking English, then at least that's how I created the pretext of my using English. But I did not really, really begin to write English until one day in Bethesda, Maryland, there was a terrible snowstorm, and I began to write in English. And all of a sudden, I was writing that, and I said, well, what have I done? I've gone back to English. What do I do with this? And then my friends at the IPS said, we have somebody at the New York Times. And all of a sudden, there I was. I had written the first piece I've ever written in English in my life, published in the New York Times. And it began my journey towards being this bridge, this person who accepts the fact that he does belong to two cultures and that they're not antagonistic, but that the tension between them, and there is a tension between them, like there's a tension between Latin America and the United States, and a tension between being a privileged person like I am and being the sort of supposedly the voice of the neglected. I'm not the voice of anybody, but those contradictions, you have to look at them in the face and make that tension become enriquecedor, meaning it enriches you, right? It makes you grow. And I think the book is written from that perspective of saying, you know what? I've been through these experiences, and I think that the world would be a better place if people were able to look at themselves in the sort of way which I'm looking at myself. I'm not saying that I'm a model for anybody. I'm only a model in as much as You know, you didn't die in La Moneda and I didn't die in La Moneda. That creates a great burden upon us. You better make a good life of it. If you're not going to die next to Allende, you better live something that's worth living. And what I decided is that I have a capacity for speaking in certain ways and understanding myself and not lying about what happened to me, which I think disarms the fear that we have, because we're very scared of showing what we are and showing ourselves as contradictory and showing ourselves as in process, in development.
If we look back 40 years ago to those days of Allende and the journey that you've made and that all of us have made, and many in this room have made, some not, but some yes, some began before. If we look at that, in some ways, these things that you talk about the contradictions in ourselves, the tensions between cultures, the struggle for that pull you in one direction or another, in some ways they were much easier to deal with 40 years ago in a Cold War, at least superficially they were.
It was very clear. In other words, let's say, it was very easy for the soul, right? In the sense it was very easy for us. Because we had certain schemata, we had certain dogmas about how the world was organized, who was good, who was bad, what you had to do, right? I mean, I look at the young people today and I feel sort of I don't know if the sadness is the word, because I feel very inspired by them very often, but I've talked to those with Angelica, with my wife, very often. They don't have the certainties that we had. They don't have the possibility, the experiences that we had, right? In other words, if you were political in Latin America, you had left-wing parties that knew where they were going. You had the workers on your side. They had been fighting for 50, 60 years in the coal mines, in the peasants, in the countryside. They were the ones who were for literacy. They were the ones who were against slavery. They were for suffrage for women. It was also clear, right? And the world clearly is, I mean, the world unclearly, is not what it used to be in that sense. Now, you can either repeat that and say it's just the way it used to be, or you can say the world has changed and we need to think ourselves out of the crisis. Now, how you do that without becoming, A, conservative and becoming, and losing hope, the most important thing is to continue the idea that the struggle is worth that struggle. Just because the utopias didn't work doesn't mean that, if we don't dream the world in a different way, there will be no future. There will be no new world.
One of the things that struck me about some of the opinion pieces that you've written over the years, when Pinochet was arrested or when he was dying or when he died, I could detect, maybe it wasn't there, but I thought I saw a theme. I detected a tension between a side of you that was extraordinarily compassionate, trying to understand and even empathize with people who you would have satanized 4 decades ago, and yet a strident defense of very basic principles that are in contradiction with these folks. Do you understand?
You're totally right. That is exactly right.
That pattern is real, right? I saw that.
It's absolutely real.
And I mean, how do you make that balance?
Well, but here's the important thing. You know, this book is about how I learned to overcome my rage and not to dehumanize my enemies, no matter how much they dehumanize me. Because if I dehumanize them, if I turn them into satanic people, then the result of that is automatically, inevitably, if they're satanic, they should be exterminated.
Right.
So what you're really doing is, I'm against the death penalty, yes, but I'm acting as if I want to kill them, as if I want to eliminate them from the world, right? So I don't want them to hurt others, and I want to struggle for a world where they do not have any power. But I do not want to damage, in other words, I want to, strange enough, redeem them. So when Pinochet was jailed, I said, General Pinochet, this is the best thing that could have happened to you. Because you now have, as Dostoevsky knows, the chance to redeem yourself. I don't think you will.
He didn't.
He didn't. No, he certainly did not. He didn't even read this and that. But the point is, because I will be dead as he is dead now. What remains behind there will be those words in which I'm giving him the chance to do that, right? So when he refuses to give us the desaparecidos, right? The bodies of desaparecidos, most people are saying, que hijo de puta, this and the other. In other words, what a horrible son of a bitch this guy is, right? Which doesn't add very much to what we know about him, right? In other words, it just confirms something that we know, except that, well, his mother was not exactly my favorite person either, but still, she's not responsible. Now, but what I did was say, General Pinochet says that he is at the, that he is acting in the name of the Greek, Roman, Christian civilization, right? Civilization as such. And the first epic of war of Western world is the Iliad. And the Iliad is all about the fact that when Priam comes to stand and prostrate himself in front of Achilles, Achilles cries and gives back the body of Hector. So I say, so basically you are not the Adalid, you're not the champion of civilization. On the contrary. Therefore, when Pinochet died and I was on television, they didn't bring me back ever again, but I said, you know, I was on television and I said, he shouldn't get a state funeral and he certainly shouldn't get even a military funeral because he has destroyed the military honor. The military honor the dead, the other dead. They have to. Yes. Because otherwise you don't go into battle, right?
Yes.
Not that I like the military, but at least let us see the difference between the honorable military and the mercenaries and the killers, right?
Yeah.
So this way of speaking, this way of understanding, when they say, I hope Pinochet dies in exile, and I say, no, you know, Pinochet has the right to come back to his country to die. And of course, this puts me against most of my compañeros in that sense.
Of course.
But it indicates in me the desire not to demonize that man. Not because I do not detest him, because I do, and I still do, you know, in that sense. And yet, at the same time, there's something in me that says, I will not let myself be contaminated by him, because then he's won. Which is exactly what happened here in September 11th, right?
Yes.
That happened, exactly. Which is that the United States, instead of rising to the occasion, became a terrorist nation itself. And it's very sad to see that happen, you know? Without demonizing the United States.
Right. We're going to get to Chile in a minute.
Yes.
But because I know that's going to take us down a long road that's actually longer than the time we have, I do want to shoehorn in one question that we had talked about. Talking about your personal journey in this sort of very complex, because I think it's complex in the positive sense, this very complex and nuanced worldview that you have, or this view of both tolerance and principle, I do want to take you to one specific anecdote that seemed to be a turning point for you, which was your famous encounter, I believe, in 1982, was it not, with some Polish officials?
1982, I went to the Polish embassy in Washington, D.C. You want me to tell that story?
I want you to read about the library, so
right.
Leave
so
your time.
I will tell, basically in 1982, it was a day in January, February, right? It was after Solidarność had been outlawed and the workers of Poland, so many of the trade union officials had been put into jail. And I went with a group of left-wing North Americans, Doug Ireland and Joanne Landy of the Campaign for Peace and Democracy. I went to the embassy of the People's Republic, Socialist Republic of Poland, and I met with the ambassador and told him that in the name of the socialism that I believed in, and as somebody who had been a follower of Salvador Allende, I was ashamed the fact of how they were destroying the name of socialism, and that I felt that they were dishonoring a tradition which was a tradition which had to be a democratic tradition or it was not socialist.
Yeah.
I was expelled from that embassy very quickly. And it was a turning point. As I explain here, and it's a bit too long to go into it in great detail, but This happens to most of us when our identity is, let's say, it is conjoined and congealed and frozen into a certain idea, then what you tend to do is to say, oh, yes, the Soviet Union is doing these terrible things, but look at this, they can reform, etc., right? Oh, look, look how they're treating the gays in Cuba. Oh, look how they killed this general in Cuba who was the hero of Angola. But you know what? Gosh, Fidel did the literacy and the wonderful healthcare system, the education, etc. You know, so you go to this over and over again. And so I say, there are so many things that were happening. And then finally, it was a drip and a drop, you know, it went very slowly, because in one sense, my dad was a Bolshevik and a Stalinist and a very gentle, wonderful man, and my mother was, she had founded a thing called the Slightly Reformed Conservation Life Communist Party, meaning she didn't want to get killed by the commissars, right? And I tended more towards my mother, but the rage of the moment and the aggressions against Chile and Latin America from the point of the United States tended to make me rather doctrinaire in that sense, in other words, lifting the fist up. And I don't lament the fact that I lifted my fist up, because at times, you know, you do have to lift your fist, and you do have to march, and you have to have slogans. But as I wandered the world, and as I met dissidents, and realized that many of these dissidents, even if they, I didn't care if they were funded by the CIA, I really didn't care about that, right? The point was that their exile and their drama was something I could understand.
Yeah.
So as things went by, and it wasn't when the Soviets went to Afghanistan, that wasn't enough, and there wasn't enough this and this. And finally, when in the name of socialism, they were putting the workers, the trade unions in jail, I said, enough is enough, you know? And in some sense, that prepared me for the man I am now, who is somebody who declares himself very clearly on the side of justice, on the side of struggle, on the side of liberation, and who will stand up for these things, but is not prepared to ever be quiet about anything that happens. And therefore, you know, I've signed petitions against Daniel Ortega, which means that I receive this hate mail in relation to that, you know. And when things happen in Cuba, that I have many admiration for things that happen in Cuba. When things go wrong, I'm there to say, I don't agree, you know. So I will sign for the Cuban Five, and the fact that they should not be in jail because they were just trying to find terrorists against their, right? I mean, if you're trying to get rid of terrorists, you should make them heroes rather than put them in jail here, right? At the same time, when people are repressed in Cuba because they do not have the possibility of freely expressing their opinions, I think that's a terrible mistake. Yeah. And I will denounce that. I won't spend my life denouncing it, because I understand that they're blockaded. I understand the problems that they've got. But in some sense, I cease to be a militant, meaning a soldier of the revolution, and I become a sort of a gadfly of the revolution or consciousness, in which I say exactly what I feel. And also, I recognize that I may be wrong, that it may be important, you know, to say it's more important to feed 1,000 children than to free one dissident. But I think that you cannot really feed the 1,000 children if the people are not free to say what they want.
Yeah.
And that's one of the problems of how you construct a just society. It cannot be based upon a state that is going to terrorize its own citizens. It just can't be done.
Let's, agreed. Let's go to Chile.
Let's go.
First of all, you're going to have, first of all, I have to tell you, I have to tell you that we're not going to do justice to this book tonight. So you're going to have to buy the book, because we're only going to get a very small piece of it here, and it really is a great book.
Thank you so much.
And I mean that sincerely.
You don't lie. Let's put you in.
Only when there's a Chilean carabinero with a gun at my head, I will tell them anything.
You will. You must say that your name is Portales.
Mi general.
Right. Put them up.
Right. Si, señor. We're going to save the punchline. We're going to save the meat of how this all turned out.
Okay.
For after the section that I want you to read.
Okay.
But just to set it up a little bit, you discuss how during after you're forced from Chile by the coup, you are absolutely determined to go back to Chile, like every Chilean I know here.
Perhaps even more, because the Chileans carried Chile with them.
Yes.
They were born there. They had the lullabies and they had the bananas, whereas I had adopted the country, and therefore I had a double reason for going back because I really could stay here.
Right. So, and I just but you are absolutely determined.
I was trying to get
And I want you, let's save that punchline about how that all turned out, but let's at least go to some of the brighter moments. And I want you to go to that scene in 1990, which is right after Pinochet has been voted out of power.
Right.
And a new transitional civilian government is assuming power.
No, it's already assumed power.
It's just assumed it a few months.
This is July, August. In fact, it's July of 1990.
Right.
And after having gone back many times back and forth and has suffered all sorts of strange occurrences, let's say, I am now settled in Chile. The book is organized around the following movement. It has a series of longer chapters in which I tell the story of my return to Chile, my attempt to return to Chile. And then there are a series of diary entries, which are really based upon real diary entries, but re-elaborated, of course, in a literary tone of voice. So this happens when I come back, and I have recuperated the house that we had bought in 1986. And this is about the library. And I chose to really speak this in particular to the library because this is the library, right? And this is a wonderful library. And there are very few libraries, you know, who as I just said in a little podcast or whatever it is they did, this library is central and central. It's centered. It is the center of something. So this is the fragment from the diary of my return to Chile in 1990. This is August 17th. Mi biblioteca. How often during the years of roving had I not dreamt of the day when I would hold in my hands the first book of my lost library, place it back on a shelf, turn and reach for the next one, untouched during all these years, thumb it, read a couple of lines, glide into those pages and find verses read by my younger self once upon a time, and then look up as if roused from a delirium, the next volume calling for rediscovery. How often had this future been evoked? Well, the future is now the year 1990. That's how I spent my time lately, unpacking boxes full of books, even though the rendezvous with my library has not turned out quite the way I imagined it would. When we sold the house on Vaticano Street to remedy our distressed circumstances in Washington, Angelica's sister and her then-husband Nacho packed the books and sent the boxes off to be kept by Santiago Larraín, a buddy from my adolescent chess-playing days, etc., etc. And they had put these books, just to explain, they had put the books in some boxes. And then one day Santiago called me up and told me that the Mapocho River had broken from its banks and had taken, along with the chicken coops and rabbit hutches, had taken half my library away. And I began to comfort him as if it had been his library, not mine, that was wrecked, not allowing myself uncharacteristically a morsel of self-pity. After I hung up, I sat there for a few minutes in our new home in Bethesda, musing about this lack of sentimentality regarding the library that formed the cornerstone of my life. Was it because those books had in effect vanished for me before the telephone call? And I say that even as I lay in the bleak nights of banishment and reviewed the exact ethereal order in which certain favorite tomes were lodged on a shelf, it took Santiago Larraín, this friend of mine, his call to make me realize that in spite of all that longing and love, I had not really believed in the existence of that library. So I was grateful to that river for savaging my most prized possessions. It was as if inside that much larger, more destructive flood of history that exposed my life and left me naked, this Chilean rising of the waters had rescued the library, had oddly made it tangible for me once more. Instead of mourning the half that had been lost forever, I rejoiced at the resurrection of what I had given up for dead. A time machine, that's what reading from my library has turned into. Because every volume I dig out of its box here in Chile, save from the Soldier of the Deluge, offers me an expedition to the past, almost a geological inquiry into the layers of the life I used to live, a way of communing with the eyes and mind of the boy, the adolescent, and then the young man who slipped into the covers of this novel or that treatise. Is it treatise?
Treatise.
See, these are words that I don't know in English. On philosophy. Meeting old friends again, Emma Bovary and Alyosha Karamazov and Aeneas and Joseph K. and Gilgamesh and Electra and that old fool Polonius accompany me once more. Though not quite as when I last left them, I have learned something since then about dead bodies and betrayals and ethical distress. To read Dante today after having tasted the bread of exile is not like yesterday when I believed I'd live and die in the country of my choice. Here was my Cortázar. And I have to say that we are accompanied here. I'm accompanied here by my dear sister, Dina Metzger, who is my companion with me in my search for Cortázar, who became a dear friend of mine and hers. Here was my Cortázar, one of my favorite stories, La Autopista del Sur, which I read before I ever met him, before I ever sat down to listen to Bessie Smith in his apartment near Leal, before the day he confided in me that he was leaving Ugne, his then lover, and had fallen in love with Carol, before we stepped together into the sea of Ciguatanejo. I skimmed through that story again only this morning, remarking on my scraggly annotations in the margin, the same handwriting then at the age of 24 as now, some things amazingly say the same, and the shock of recognition. And then I explained how that story was related to my ideas about modernization in Chile and about the tension between progress and conservation, between the past and the future. Here, then, are the metaphors and paradigms and characters from which I can never be expelled, a vast imaginary realm that will always be mine. It was here that I learned a long time ago in the boundless pages of this library to become cosmopolitan. Diogenes must be here, Diogenes, I would say. One of these days, I'll look for the passage where he invented the word, that word derived from cosmos and polites, a citizen of the universe, someone who does not have to fear exile because, gloriously homeless, he belongs only to his thoughts and to what is eminently human. Is that why I've come back to Chile? To dust off the pre-Socratics? To dip again into the classics? To recall that Socrates, according to an essay by Montaigne, said he was not from Athens but from the world? To acknowledge that when I first read those words, I didn't really understand them as I do now, after decades of wandering. So much makes more sense now that I can visit the women protesting that their desaparecido is still without a grave, and on the same day read of Antigona's determination to bury her brother. But the collected plays of Sophocles are not just spiritual passports to the universe. They are also inside an object to be disinterred, hefty and material, and above all, dirty. The words inside may shine, but the pages that carry them are caked with the dust of their own transitory funeral. I can't read Euripides or Plato until I've wiped down the books where they reside, where they have established a residence, unless I've cleaned up the residue left behind by time and the river. Oh, yes, Thomas Wolfe is also here. I read him before I had an inkling that I'd established myself for so long in the North Carolina where he was born. I won't be able to look Homer with his angel until my muscles and fingers have done some exercise, though not alone. About 4 hours after I had started on my labors, I came down with an asthma attack. The previous evening, I had already been left dizzy by the noxious smog of Santiago, the third time in as many weeks. This is also mi querido Chile, this mad miasma welcome, the crushing headaches, the substandard gasoline, the buses belching fumes, the misguided industrialization of ages exacerbated by the anything-goes dictatorship, and the public indifference to the common good, and of course the mountains that I love so much, the mountains hemming in that foul air, exacting revenge of the descendants of the conquistadors, today's October 12th, who came to despoil and celebrate this valley. You see how I say they came to despoil and celebrate? I can never say one without the other. I can't demonize them entirely. The heaving beast in my lungs had subsided by the time I awoke the next morning, but the spores in the books ferreted their way into me soon enough, so that by noon an allergic reaction endangered the great rescue. At this rate, it was going to take me more weeks to clean up my library than it had taken Tolstoy to write the Battle of Borodino, maybe longer than Napoleon's retreat from Moscow, which I was itching to read again in the constant Garnett translation. I would glance at the description of Pierre watching the slaughter and then sneeze, read another line about Pierre's yearnings for Natasha, and then dab my eyes. And so it would have continued if salvation had not come at the hands of a spindly 12-year-old with a shudder of unruly black hair and cleaved olive skin. Miguel was at our house with his father, a stonemason summoned by Angelica to cover the exposed bricks in Joaquin, that's our youngest son's, bedroom, so the tiny spiders and bugs won't creep out and attack our son. Miguel should be in school, but I suspect he's been pulled out of the system, that his dad wants him to start working. Not that he's much of an apprentice, as the kid kept floating away from the masonry work job to contemplate me pounding the soil away from a binding and then absorbed in one of William Blake's poems, and then estornudo, it was a sneeze, and a similar operation with Rilke or Lagerquist. And I can't remember quite how or when it happened. It would have been narratively appropriate if it had been when I was trying to salvage Oliver Twist. All I know is that Miguel suddenly appeared with a rag. Concerned by my health, Angelica, let's say, she had instructed Miguel to sit down on one of the boxes on the red tiled terrace of our patio and make himself useful. And so he began taking out books, scrubbing each one at a clip 10 times faster than anything I could accomplish, weighed down as I was with asthma and curiosity, and my hankering for a repetition of the pleasures of Le Temps Retrouvé. He's been my assistant for the past few days, a bright kid, quickly able to classify like-minded books in piles that I can then accommodate in relative order on the wooden boards of the rapidly filling study. It is not a strict division of labor in which the boy sweats and I read, because I'm also getting my fingernails filthy, but there can be no doubt that my aide-de-camp bears the main burden of this toil. He is happy as he plugs away, especially when the talk turns to the books. Besides making more money in these scant hours than he'll earn for the rest of the month, I doubt that his father pays him at all. Miguel is receiving the rudiments of a literary education denied to him by the accident of his birth. He's avid for the stories embedded under the covers which I transmit to him from time to time as he wipes away the grime with fruition. Miguel nods, frowning with concentration when I recite some lines from Nicolás Guillén or tell him a fable by Jorge Luis Borges. Borges, whose work I love in spite of having been decorated by Pinochet. Borges, who wrote about a library as infinite as the universe, but never once conjured up a child scrubbing his ficciones, that's one of the books of Borges, on a sunny day in winter. Never once stopped to think that the intellectual delectations of eternity and avatars could be denied to that boy because of what that very general had inflicted on our country. Never understood that if this were still ahí en this Chile, Miguel would inhabit a nation where his future, as a reader and as a worker, would be diametrically different. I didn't expect to be using the services of anyone like Miguel. In fact, the dinner at Antonio Scanavita's 5 or 6 days ago, my dear friend Antonio, upon hearing my latest tribulations, I spent a whole morning flitting to offices scattered across the city in order to retrieve a package from Nan Gray, my editor at Viking in New York, Antonio suggested that if he and I and maybe another writer pooled our resources, we could share a junior, se llama así en inglés, en castellano, a junior, un junior, who could run our errands and would better off with us than by begging on the streets or selling asparagus one day and trinkets made in Hong Kong the next. I launched into an Arielesque tirade about our fraudulent service society, its roots in the semi-feudal past, why we assumed that so many of the poor were automatically supposed to do our bidding, and added that I wouldn't pander to such exploitation. My years abroad had taught me to unshackle myself from this sort of bond. A prodigious speech, but look at me now, less than a week later, with my very own private helpers. You can see the contradictions just flow freely. Though not for long, the library cleaning is coming to its end. Tomorrow I'll send Miguel off with an extra large tip and some books, and then indulge my fancy with other Miguels remaining behind with me, Miguel de Cervantes and Miguel Ángel Asturias and Miguel Street by Naipaul, and of course, Michel de Montaigne. What did he say, my Michel, about poverty in the mind? I shuffle through the cold to the almost full library and find the essay perched close to Eluard and Rabelais. I open the volume, find the phrase underlined by a furious pencil that was once mine. Poverty of goods is easily cured. Poverty of the mind is irreparable. What I had already selected as notable from Montaigne years ago. When I first read that line, I actually believed it was possible to cure the pandemic of poverty, yet here I am in Chile, brimming with kids like Miguel and so many other that I mentioned them immediately. Here I am slumming for stories, hoping to add more works of my own to this library, hoping that I can carry on the only struggle left to me in this land, wagering that the poverty of our nation's mind is not as irreparable as my dead Michel de Montaigne, now rescued from a sullied river, once wrote. Because something is beginning to form in my mind. Something is starting to call from inside me, from out there in the country. Something is asking me for the words it needs to be born. Something to assuage the sorrow for me, for Miguel, for all of us. So, thank you. I just wanted to say two things. And one is that in this city, there are thousands of Miguels. And you have to keep this library open, if only for them. You have to give as much as you can to keep this library because Miguel has no other place to go. He can't go to my library. I can't help him, right? You can help him. You can help that child, those many, many children who are there waiting. You know, I've been in many places and they always charge to come and listen to me. And this is free. And it should be free. In fact, all culture should be free. But the fact that you have this place, that you have all these computers where the kids can come, where they have the library card, they were just telling me, you know, the president of one of the foundations, how important that is. It's really, really central that you keep that going, because when you close the library, what you do is you close the mind of the country, you close the mind of the city, you close the mind of Miguel. How can you betray that child who doesn't even know we're here at this moment? How can we do that? We should not do that, you know. And you can see the tremendous sorrow and hope that there is in this memoir. This is very typical. I wanted to read this. I wanted to read something so you could get a sense of my sorrow for my country, right? And my hope for it at the same time. And all the contradictions that come out of that. So thank you so much for that. And the other thing is that what was stirring in me, in fact, was Death and the Maiden.
Well, that's the last question I want to sneak in, because I know it's about... We want to leave some time for
questions.
Yes,
I'm sorry. It was a longer than...
No, it's fine. It was actually quite beautiful. And proves that English can actually be a beautiful language. It's not just a language for talking to horses, as some people claim.
There's nothing wrong with talking to horses, believe me. I wish we did it more.
You go back to Chile. Pinochet is commander-in-chief, but he's no longer the dictator.
He's a shadow, but he's not a
body. The force. The civilians are coming back to power. All of these political parties that we were associated with in some form or another come back. You are finally back in Chile, and you have the brilliant idea of confronting the Chilean people with your work, Death and the Maiden, which is an amazing work and a quite a fine film directed by Polanski.
Yes, indeed.
In which it is all about not just torture, but the torture of coexisting with torturers.
It is about the aftermath of a dictatorship and how it damages absolutely everybody.
And this play, in some form or another, I think it's the most widely produced play in the world, isn't it? Or one of the
most? For 3 years, it was the most widely produced play in the world. And we're just having a revival with Tandy Newton in London, which is I'm going to after this.
It didn't go over that well in Chile in 1990.
No, it did not.
Did it?
Yeah.
And
it was called by a contemporary of mine the worst play in the history of Chile.
I've been called the worst political reporter in California, but that was by the governor's aide.
I think that didn't hurt you, but it did hurt me when they said that to me, you know, because it was a friend.
We want to leave time for questions, but yes. I do want you to answer this. Link the reaction, the negative reaction to that play, to your eventual decision after nearly two decades, of being absolutely determined to live in Chile, to decide that you absolutely were not going to live in Chile.
Well, what happens is that when I return to Chile, I decide that I'm going to be silent for 6 months, which is not easy for me, as you probably realize, right? It's not easy. And especially because I had been silent during the first years of exile. I'd been unable to write for different reasons. And I tell the story of how I tried to write on a toilet seat in Paris. It's a sort of funny, sad story. Now, when I come back to Chile then, what I discover is that nobody in the country is writing about or even talking about the most dramatic events of all, which is this cohabitation, as if it were a natural rather than a monstrous thing, and the most dramatic situation that I can think of. And behind the fact that people weren't finding a space to tell those sort of stories, and that I could tell it because in some sense I was still in exile, because I had lived outside Chile and was coming back with all my baggage from abroad. And I prepared in some way. Because John Berger, with whom I'd been talking about the returning, I said, that they were asking me, what are you going to write when Pinochet's gone? And I said, well, there's other things I can write. And he was saying, you must write as if Pinochet was already defeated. This he tells me in 1987. Right. And I write Mascara. So when I go back, I feel that this story needs to be told, and that this is my gift to my country, in the sense I'm giving to my country the possibility of looking itself in the mirror.
Yeah.
And you know, monsters don't like to look at themselves in the mirror, you know? And also, it was a play which was, if it had been a play about torture, it might have been accepted. It was a play which did the following things. The person who was most violent on stage was the victim, not the supposed perpetrator, therefore turning the tables, right? And therefore asking the basic question is, am I going to become like the person who hurt me, right? First. Second, the person who was the most deceiving person, cunning person, secretive person, and manipulative person is the human rights lawyer, right, who, of course, is the one who has made the transition possible and is now in the government,
right,
and who is willing to sacrifice many things, and who's a very decent, noble person, but who, for the common good, is prepared to accept the pain of his own wife, right, and the secret, right? And where the story is about how, in order to make that democracy work, you have to betray that woman and betray her many times over. In other words, she's got to be neglected. She can't rebel. She's got to be, in other words, if she was blindfolded before, now she's gonna be gagged. She has no right to speak. And the fact that you really don't know what happened, that it's ambivalent to say that to the right or to the left, is an anathema. Because what do you mean we don't know what happened? We know people were tortured. Of course people were tortured. And of course it was good, say the people of the right. Oh, we didn't know, right? So what I do is I call into question the whole transition in some sense, not by saying that I disagree with the transition, because I was very much in favor of it. And I think that we did almost a model transition, but that I said that that must be accompanied by telling that truth. And when finally, I mean, it was scandalously, the elite of Chile boycotted it.
Right.
The pobladores who saw it loved it, and but they weren't the one who were paying the tickets. They weren't going to the theater. And many years later, I met President Alwyn, who said, "I understand that you've got problems because of what happened, right?" and I said, "Yes, I did." And you know what he said to me? He said, "Look, the politicians have got to do some things, and the writers have got to do other things. And you're doing what you have to do." Now, nobody said that to me that time. What they would say is, "Es muy inoportuno, this is inopportune. This is not an opportunity." But I had learned, one of the things I had learned is, you do not wait for the opportunity to say things. You don't wait for things to be ready for everybody, because people will never be ready to listen to the truth, right? And of course, my problem is I want two contradictory things. I want to be loved by everybody, and I want to pour salt in their wounds and provoke them and disturb them. So those things create trouble for me. But Death and the Maiden, the reaction to the fact that there was not space in Chile for this vision of mine, as there was not space in Chile for my ecological ideas, for the fact that I was outraged when people were throwing wrapping paper all over. You've seen that, right? The beaches that were full of, right? There was not space for my fight for the rights of women, the rights of indigenous people, the rights of. I mean, there's so many things that I'd learned abroad in some ways, right? And that there was not a space for that, that there were anti-homosexual jokes over and over again that really riled me. All of that began to accumulate. But I guess I could have lived with some of that, as people do live with that. You live like that in the States for a long, long time, and there are places where in the United States where it's still like that, right? But that there's not a space for the memory that I want to bring and for the vision that I want to bring and for the literature, plus the fact that, you know, Angelica was unhappy and Joaquin was unhappy and there wasn't space for the youth. You know, if I had had the youth rebellion that there is in Chile now, the ecological rebellion that there is in Chile now, I probably wouldn't have left.
Yeah.
Because they are bringing back the country that was my country, my dream. But I can't dream that country and continue living the nightmare of what that transition was, even if it was a wonderful transition. In other words, there was not space for me. The country, I didn't fit into the country, or the country didn't fit into me. And rather than continuing to think that that was the case, I had to accept the fact that finally I needed to leave. Because I had lived with the distance, I had fallen in love with the distance, and the distance from Chile allowed me to say things to Chile, but also allowed me to do things in relation to the world. You know, I've written screenplays about torture victims among the British. I just wrote an opera about child prostitutes in India, and it's a funny opera, no. child soldiers in Africa and desaparecidos in Latin America, based on the Upanishads. What I mean is, the world had, in some sense, entered me. I came back with that world to Chile, and Chile was not interested in that vision. And I didn't want to, you know, I'm a person who's very gentle in his everyday life. I don't fight with people. I'm not in conflict. I'm in conflict in my writing. But I want to live with a certain peace. And I felt as if there was no peace. And I speak about one moment here where a friend of mine, I would go to the funeral of a friend. And, you know, one of the things that happens in exile is you're unable to go, you're unable to be with your friends as they die. The friends die and you're not there. And therefore, you're not able to say goodbye to them. And they're not able to return. They're not able to go to the other side of death with a memory of you. And you're not able to receive from them what they remember of you when you were young. So there's that double loss, right? So I went to the funeral of my friend, having been able to spend 3 hours with her before she died. And another friend said, I told her about my tribulations. He said, you have to grow elbows. You got, And I said, you know what? I don't want to do this. I don't want to spend my life elbowing people like this, you know, like that, making a space for myself. Here I am. Let me. No, I don't want to live like that. In other words, I either have a natural place, an organic place inside my life and my country, or I'm going to go back to a place where I can, from the distance that I've come to admire and love and need, and where I in some sense, I'm welcome. And I mentioned, you know, the fact that there are many people in this room, in fact, who are acknowledged here, like Gordon Davidson is acknowledged here. There are people who are acknowledged here who received me and will give me refuge. And in some sense, it's very strange to have more friends in Holland who are ready to receive me than in my own Santiago.
Yeah.
But that's the price that you pay for telling the truth. And eventually, you know, I have to embrace that possibility. I have to embrace my doubleness and understand that it's not something which diminishes me. It's painful. There's a loss there. But that I cannot deny any longer. And so Angelica and I and Joaquin leave Chile. Rodrigo had already left. And we go back from time to time. You know, in some cases, very triumphantly. Like when you go back with the film of Death and the Maiden, you know, and then all of a sudden, the same people who had sent their chauffeurs to see the play come and sit and say, oh, I saw the play. And the people have stopped me on the streets of Santiago and say, viejito lindo, yo sí que vi la obra. I really saw the play, right?
And he was among the 12, right?
No. I say to them, well, I'm very glad, but if everybody who says they saw the play had seen it, it would still be on.
Right. Well, we're running a little bit behind schedule, so I'm not sure how we take the questions here. Okay.
I've got
about 25 more questions, so we'll see who's clairvoyant and can ask the questions in my head or in yours.
There's.
I wanted to ask you if Bachelet and Cristina in Argentina and the Brazilian woman president, is there a significance to that, or is just that it's a different gender?
Well, the different gender is very significant, let's say. I mean, obviously, it's very significant. It's very significant, you know, because we did have women presidents in Latin America. They were the wives of former presidents or former generals, right? And so, you know, to say that Isabel de Perón is a ruler with her witch doctor is not exactly something which you could say that it helps the witch doctors of the world, but does not necessarily, and I'm speaking of the bad witch doctors, you know, but it doesn't help the women of the world because it doesn't give the image of what women can do. So when Michelle Bachelet became the first woman who had been elected popularly on her own merits, right? In fact, in spite of the fact that she was the daughter of a general who had been assassinated by Pinochet, it was a great step forward. But we have to look at it in the following context. In that same Latin America, you have the first trade union official, a trade union representative, who is Lula, who becomes a president. I mean, you have to understand what that means. Allende had, as Minister of Labor, a trade union, the head of the CUT, of the Central Única de Trabajadores, and had put a peasant, Rolando Alarcón, Calderón.
Rolando
Calderón. Alarcón is the singer. Rolando Calderón as the minister of agriculture. Lands, you know. But when you think of the fact that then you have somebody like Lula, who was jailed and was the head of the metallurgical union, And then you have in Bolivia, the first indigenous person who becomes, who was, you know, he was a goat herder in Aymara, in the highlands of the Andes. So when you look in that context, what is happening is that those who make history begin to have a space in that history. And I think it's extremely significant, you know? That's extremely significant that you have a woman who's a president of Liberia. It's very important to those things. And I used to say this to Isabel Letelier. I don't know if Pancho Letelier is here or not. I'm hoping that he did come, but if he didn't, anyway. I used to say, Isabel Letelier, that if she were president of Chile, I would become minister of culture of the Trutruca, which is sort of a native indigenous. So that I would only become a member of a government that had a woman as the head of the government, right? Not because women don't do terrible things, because, you know, all you have to do is look at Maggie Thatcher, and that indicates certain things. So it's not gender does not free you of dictatorship and of terrible things. Women can be as terrible as men, right? But there are ways in which women have learned about the world that I think allows them to understand politics in a very different way, or at least to teach both men and women in a different way. And so I think it was very significant. And it's very significant that Michelle Bachelet has an 86% approval rating, right? And that if she does run for president again, she will be the next president of Chile, which I hope she does. Let's hope that happens.
Thank you very much for a fascinating conversation. The question is a bit of a personal nature. So as a Muslim of Pakistani origin who decided to make U.S. his home in the post 9/11 world, I sometimes face the same contradiction that you speak of. And it seemed like America's seemingly going to the phases where it is finding its own identity of sorts, and it's not able to make up its mind. And even Obama was seemingly a hope, but it isn't turning out to be the case. Do you see in the future a turning away from the direction we're heading right now for America?
Well, I mean, it depends on us.
Right.
In the sense that clearly, you know, one of the reasons why Muslims can come to America is because, in fact, they're free to worship here, right? It's true. There is a lot of anti-Muslim sentiment, but there's also, even Bush himself spoke against anti-Muslim hatred, right? And I think this is a very important factor of what this country is. Now, is that America going to prevail? If it's not going to prevail, America is going to fall and destroy itself. Because it is based upon, in other words, what is good in America is precisely that possibility that you can speak out as a Muslim, live as a Muslim, and that it really doesn't matter whether you're a Muslim or not. People are not going to judge you because of your religious beliefs or because you believe in this God or another God, right? Or because of the skin that you have or the accent that you have or the way your eyes are slanted in one way or the darkness of your hair or your lightness of your hair, right? I mean, that's what this country is supposedly about. And it keeps on being what Obama himself speaks about, an imperfect project, right? That's got to be perfected. Now, what is tragic is that after the events of 9/11, the country veered off in exactly the wrong direction, both internationally and domestically, and created a false sense of fear, and tried to create a sense of security, which, it, you know, we can't be secure in the ways in which some of the people say we have to be secure. We have to live in insecurity. We have to live. That's what it means to live in insecurity, to live towards that which we do not know. So I can only pray that you will find in your compatriots the possibility of doing that. I think that part of that has to do with the way in which also the Muslim community has reacted, which I think is a very mature way of doing it. Because the fight is not between, of course, Christians and Muslims or between America and the Muslims, right? No matter how much some people in power would like that to be the case. There is a struggle inside Christianity, as there is a struggle inside the Muslim community, as there is a struggle inside the Jewish community, as there is inside the Hindu community, right? I mean, inside each of the big, great religions, there has been, and this has been a case from the very beginning, there is a case between the fundamentalists and between those who want more freedom. And then on the very fringes are the ones that I really like, who are the mystics, like the Sufis among the Muslims or the heretics among the Christians, right? Those are my heroes. And when we are able to accept those heretics as being those who illuminate the future, then we're going to be out of trouble. I hope. We'll see.
Hello. I first came across your play, Death and the Maiden, when it was translated into Bengali. I was living in, I'm originally from Bangladesh. And
I've never seen it, so I'd love to hear the words in Bengali. I don't even have that.
And a famous playwright there, he translated, he and his wife, and they staged the play in Bengali because Bangladesh at that time was transitioning from a dictatorship to a democracy, and it really resonated with me. But my question is, you, earlier in your talk, you had mentioned that the young people of today are finding this world much more complex and they don't know how to deal with it in a progressive way without, you know, resorting to fundamentalism or whatever, or being right-wing. But I get the sense that, you know, the world was always complex. It was, we probably, and intellectuals like yourself included, probably looked at it in a bipolar world, but I think we never lived in a bipolar world. So can you comment on that, please?
But no, you're absolutely right. The world was much more complex. But when you don't see it with all its complexity, when you're, it's very much related to what I could call the fight against dictatorship, right? When you have a dictator like Pinochet or like Gaddafi, right, to give an example, the fight against those people is so clear in relation, it's a very complex phenomenon, but they represent such an extreme of cruelty and malice and deception that we look as if we were shining knights of armor, right? As if we were, you know, we're just so intact and perfect. I mean, really, when I compare myself to Pinochet. No, seriously, you know, when you compare yourself to Pinochet, the small transgressions that I confess to here are very insignificant. But the point about this is that that to say that I'm better than Pinochet is not to say very much, right? So what we need to do is we need to understand that things are complex in that sense. And when the dictator disappears, then I at least was much free, I was liberated to be able to address some of that complexity. But we are, this is what's happening, this is what I think is the danger in America today, which is that things are so dire and there's such a crisis that the oversimplification, the sloganeering, and the substitution of thought, instead of having thought, you have screaming and sound bites, when all of that is the way in which the public forum, the discussion occurs, then it is up to us to return to the forum what the forum is, which is the idea of many different ideas discussing. And that the idea that just because you're an adversary of somebody doesn't mean that you can't listen to them and that you learn from the other person, right? When the person challenges you. So it was always very complex, the world, but we used to think the solutions were very simple. It was, if you had asked this young man what the solutions were, I knew what the solutions were. And it turns out that if I had been right, this would be a very different world. So not that I was wrong to think in that way. It's simply that I wasn't mature enough that the world, I had not been able to free myself from these major dichotomies that were in the world. And I think that I've become triangular, let's say, right? Because I'm no longer binary. I believe everything is in a triangle of some sort. Okay. Could we do the following? Could we take 4 or 5 questions and I'll try to answer all of them together? Because that way, lots of people will speak and I'm sure many of them will be related one to the other. No, but it's just, if you're very brief and say these things,
if the
and very
questions
quickly,
are very short.
Very short questions and then
one,
I'll try
one,
to...
One sentence questions.
Ariel. Javier de Sacier, pedagógico, o sea, han pasado un par de semanas.
¿Cómo te llamas tú?
Javier de Sacier, hermano.
Oh, hola, Javier, ¿cómo estás?
Y qué orgulloso verte. O sea, tengo una pregunta, o sea, aparte de gente que andabas con, o sea, con Escármeta, con Carlos Alberto, con la OEA, güey, ¿me entendés? Perdiste los libros en el Mapocho. ¿Qué puta hiciste con la bufanda, güey?
Ah, my God. He wanted to find out what the hell I did with my scarf, that I had a scarf, right? The scarf was lost along with the books. I took it off. No, who knows what I did with the scarf?
Hello. I'm very inspired to hear your compassionate heart digging. Hi, Michael. digging for a different way of looking at the monster. It's really inspiring. My question is from the experience you've had with in your life with countries and upheavals, how you would see what's going on down the street with people protesting uh-huh. in front of City Hall. I'd love to hear what you would have to say about that.
Yeah.
Okay, that's question two and number three.
We've got the... We've got... Oh, here, there's somebody down here who's already got something.
I apologize. Mine is not a question. I am so privileged to be in your presence.
Oh, please.
Tonight. I'm sorry. I'll apologize. Your capacity to refuse dichotomizing and embrace contradiction is so bracing that, you know, when they ask young people, who would you like to have dinner with of all the people who have been alive? I would like to have you at my dinner table.
All I can say is... All I can offer is that my book can be at your dinner table, at least.
I've got your book.
Thank you, Manuel.
I read your splendid commentary in The Nation comparing 9/11 in the U.S. with 9/11 in Chile.
And Gandhi. Yes.
And then Gandhi.
Thank you.
Okay. We have a younger son who now lives in Japan and has a Japanese wife. So I'm reading a great deal about Japanese history and also about Hiroshima, and about the disavowal, disingenuousness, denial, and lying about the bomb. And I cannot help but feel that there is a trajectory from Hiroshima.
From one ground zero to the other, you mean?
From one ground zero to another.
So is there another question, or is that basically... Stop. I'm sorry. The people are so... I'm so sorry.
You need to give a one-sentence answer about the Occupy.
I know. I will do that. I will do that. I promise. If you allow one more, I promise that I will answer the question about the occupying.
Yeah. You mentioned about the youth when you were growing up, or you know, in the 70s in Latin America, about being left or right, and somehow we knew, because I come from El Salvador, and I went through a civil war, and when somehow the youth knew, you know, about the struggles that we were fighting for, right? But now we live in, through all this, the youth, I mean, in El Salvador, there are like 10 people or 15 people die every day,
yeah,
okay? And we don't know where we're going. So I would like to know, you know, where Latin America is going, what is the future agenda. I know that it was ahead of his time because he won elections democratically, right? Like Evo Morales now. So that is my point. Where Latin America is going and what is the relationship with United States, with the drugs and all these kind of things that are going on? Because there is a lot of people, a lot of young people dying in Central America, Latin America now, and it's all drug-related.
I need to be very blunt in relation to my answer to you, and I really sympathize and understand the pain, but there is no way in which I can answer that question now because it would entail a long lesson in history about what's happening now, where it comes from, et cetera. You know, I mean, I can only say that I can hope that the signs of hope towards the future are better than the signs of despair. That's all I can say. Let me go with that to the question about what's happening right here, right now. And what I've been answering in general, because I've been asked about this continually, and I love the fact that my book is coming out precisely at this moment, because this is a book, after all, about somebody who's been through revolution, who has been through transitions of democracy, and been through repression. So I've been through all these different forms, and they've formed me, they shaped me in some way. And my answer to that is that the people who are protesting now, feel as if they have been exiled from their country. They feel as if this is not their country. They do not recognize this as America. This is not the America of this land is your land, this is the land for you and me, right? It's the land of the greed and not the land of the need. And I think that though I am always skeptical of any movement that, in other words, I always want to make sure that I'm not too enthusiastic about anything that happens, right? Because I don't want to overemphasize the fact of this rebellion, because I've seen how often rebellions can go into other courses. So I don't want to blind myself. But I think there is a purity in this. There is a joy in this. There is a nonviolence especially, which I find very interesting, according to what my friends have told me, you know. There is a sense in which what especially young people are saying is, to the power in this country is, you have given us a country where we have no hope. We are going to take the country back and say this is a country of hope. And there is no change. The leaders are not going to lead unless the people push them in that direction. And this has got to be happening. Now, Allende is not somebody who only leads. He is the result of 70 years of struggle of the Chilean people. And we could almost say thousands of years of struggle of the human race, right? I mean, we've been fighting for these things for a long, long time. And so this latest movement is a movement in which people say to themselves, we have had enough. We are going to, I would rather they speak about reoccupying America rather than occupying America, because I don't like occupations. I do like reoccupations, meaning that which has been denied to them, they are saying, you know what, this is our land, and we're going to reoccupy it. Reocuparlo, in some sense. And they should preoccupy it in the sense they should make it a preoccupation. They should think about it. It's not enough. And I think that's happening. Now, will the older people, I would say, because there are older people also involved in that, are we ready to understand what is happening? Are we ready to take the wisdom that we've got to that? But there's something wonderful that is happening, right? And this is a country that deserves those young people. And I think that if we could declare a truce and say, they will not be touched, they will not be hurt because of what they're doing, we will not turn this country into a police state out of fear of what these people are, these young people especially, are asking for, it would be a great step forward. And it seems like Los Angeles is one of those places. It seems like San Francisco is one of those places. So let's see. I mean, let's see what parts of the country become more liberated. But let's realize that the first thing is, before you liberate any street, you always liberate your mind and your heart. And that's what I think, I hope, is happening. That's what I've been trying to do through this. And thank you so much for coming. And thank you. Thank you, Mark, so much.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.